com. This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Have in the studio Christopher Harmon. He's the current Major General Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University down in Quantico. He was formerly the Director of Studies and Program of Terrorism and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies. And he's also, is it an adjunct, Chris, or are you at the Institute of World Politics?
An adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics.
Outstanding. And teaching about terrorism and
counterterrorism. Yes, I have a course that will be running in the spring on terrorism and counterterrorism over there.
Outstanding. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you, Derek.
You know, we've been talking before we even got the show started about terrorism and its long-term effects. A lot of people think that terrorism just started in 9/11, but it didn't. You know, as we define the word terrorism, as we define what it is, and because your book, you guys have a book called A Grand Strategy Against Terrorism that you and several of your colleagues have just written and edited. What is terrorism? Define that for us.
Yes, Derek, the major elements of it are political objectives, the creation of fear, the kind of premium on psychology and manipulation of people, and above all, the victimization of the innocent. Now, it can be difficult to say who's innocent and who's not, but overwhelmingly, the established terrorist groups pick their victims in a way that emphasizes civilians, but also emphasizes those who are not a part of the fight, whatever that may be. And they do that very deliberately and self-consciously. And so we worry more than terrorists do, I think, about exactly how to define the innocent. But they're pretty well aware, and they deliberately choose victims in a way that will shock and compel attention.
You know, in your research, I mean, do you find that terrorists, I mean, you know, their mothers, I mean, their fathers, I mean, their people as well. I mean, when they choose these civilian targets, has their mindset gotten to a point of that they believe so strongly in what they believe in that it doesn't really matter about the collateral damage what they're causing, or it doesn't matter that we're killing civilians. We just need to get the result. Is that what they're looking at?
Yes. It's a very harsh process of calculation, sort of like what a criminal goes through when he assesses what it'll take to rob a bank, and he knows it's likely he may end up engaged in shooting someone, but he assumes those risks. A terrorist looks at targeting with a more explicit desire to actually do physical damage or do psychological damage, and it is quite calculated. A lot of terrorists have written memoirs. I'm reading one by an IRA man right now. I read them frequently as they emerge. There have been memoirs by Palestinians. There's a long, long interview by Abimael Guzman, who founded the Sendero Luminoso group in Peru. You can read the individuals themselves, and they'll often discuss this.
In your reading, I mean, what did you get into psychology, into the psychosis of these people? I mean, is it, you know, as you're looking at it, I mean, what are you seeing from these people? If we did a behavior analysis, is there a common thread?
It's a good question. There's almost no success at establishing a clear profile of the generic terrorist. A lot of people have tried, including a very smart man locally here, Gerald Post, who did profiling for CIA and is now at George Washington University. There's a nice review of efforts to do this by the Library of Congress, which in 1999 did a very fine study on terrorism, edited by a fellow named Rex Hudson. Whether you're looking at those kinds of general reports or the specific work of a doctor like Gerald Post, you move pretty soon to the idea that there is no given clear profile, but there are some common characteristics, Derek. For example, if we look at the current enemy now, while I'm quite attuned to females in terrorism and have done a lot of study of this, I'm not seeing that kind of presence within the Al-Qaeda operative ranks. They're probably in supportive roles, intelligence roles, acting in financing or transport of financing and documents, but they're not, most of them are.
They're not operational.
Not very often. There are certainly some suicide bombers. There have been some other operators. But compared to the 60s and 70s, when I was studying the terrorists of the communist side, there was a third or more, perhaps, of the in a typical group might be females. This was true in Shining Path, which I mentioned. But in this case, they're usually males. They tend, more often than not, the activists, tend to be in the late teens and 20s and early 30s. They do tend to be ideologically committed. They do tend to be mentally sane. It's a mistake to say that they're likely to be particularly aberrant psychologically. Some may be. You can make an easy case for certain of those I've studied, like Abu Nidal. But for a lot of these guys, they are, as one scholar once said, disturbingly normal.
Disturbingly normal, meaning that these people are just people we could see every day on the street, have a go to Starbucks and have a good conversation with. Is that what we're kind of talking about? Almost?
Well, there's a long process that they tend to go through mentally, but it doesn't necessarily show on the street or in Starbucks. Hmm. And they are political actors, and that's the important part about defining terrorism. That there's, for example, a kind of nexus we could discuss between some crime and terror, but. But these guys primarily have political motives. They are, however, fanatics as opposed to people who have views that might range from the light to the moderate to the more extreme. They're extreme in their views. They're fanatical, and they're willing to kill the innocent for them. I do take very seriously their ideas. I think it's a mistake to see it only as a matter of a past deprivation or a current crisis of some kind or economic problems, or it's more frequently closely related to forms of political fanaticism.
And that gets me to this question. What's the root? I mean, you're kind of going into this right now about what is the root that causes these terrorist groups to, and we look throughout history, any of them, whatever country, what causes them to become a terrorist group? I mean, you mentioned about political, the ideas, the ideology. What is it that happens?
In the case of the largest enemy for the West right now, which are kind of what I called once the militant Muslim international, meaning a specific genre of people, Islamists captivated by an ideological form of fanaticism. In this case, there are, I think, mixed roots. Part of it is spiritual. Part of it is political. And part of it has to do with who their colleagues and friends are. That is, there are some poisonous ideas in the air which are captivating to them. There's web sources which are fascinating to them. There are manuals for Al-Qaeda, which I've actually taught for the Marine Corps, for example, in Quantico. There are a lot of sources for these ideas, and they, by communing with one another, they tend to kind of intensify the normal sorts of political concerns, fears, hatreds, and these become a kind of a sump of some pretty poisonous things which they can then draw on for the motives for their action. There's no predictable way they come into a group. Sometimes it's a spiritual mentor. Sometimes it's a charismatic leader. Occasionally it's a lover who's inside the organization who might bring the spouse in or the girlfriend in as a courier, for example. So again, terrorists are very difficult to profile.
Well, as we're kind of thinking about that, and what I'm hearing is a couple different dynamics. You have a leadership dynamic of people who are true believers and have a certain kind of mindset of why we're doing this. And then you have those who kind of come in and have been either recruited to now do work or, you know, even as we talked about the Mumbai situation, and you kind of look at the tapes about these guys. Some of them said, I just did this for money, or they had my family, or a number of different reasons. These people went out to carry out these actions, but they weren't necessarily the leaders of it. I mean, with all of that, I mean, are there two groups of people within terrorism?
Well, what I like about your question is I think it gets towards the dual center of gravity, if you like. Good old Clausewitz, who mostly was a student of conventional war, but also partisan war and some certain amount of guerrilla war. Clausewitz, he saw a lot of that in his career. Clausewitz asks us to try to figure out what's the primary hub, the sort of wheel center from which all this activity emanates, and he calls that the center of gravity. And I think in the case of the modern jihadi, the self-proclaimed jihadi types, you're looking at a dual center of gravity. There is a leadership cadre. I include Mullah Omar, who's a very talented, very credible leader of the Taliban, and a very disturbing leader to study. Certainly al-Zawahiri, certainly bin Laden. That top three makes kind of an important troika for our major global problems now. But the second center of gravity is the ideas, the doctrine, the kind of perverse ideology of Islamism. And those two things, when combined together, motivate very strong passions.
Having in the studio with me, Chris Harmon. He's a Major General Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University. He's an expert on terrorism and counterterrorism. He formerly was the Director of Studies for the Program of Terrorism and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies. And he's an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics teaching on terrorism. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. The right technology, right away. Local and state governments are under tremendous pressure to do more for citizens and do it better. How is technology helping local and state governments do just that? How is the state of Illinois using technology to improve human service delivery? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with special guest Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer of the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour. This federal government update is brought to you by the U.S. General Services Administration.
Military workers moving to Maryland due to base realignment and closing commission plans can now get $2,500 to help them buy a home. The BRAC Match program allows homebuyers to use the money as part of their down payment or for closing costs if the home is bought through the Maryland Mortgage Program. The money is available to both civilians and military personnel affected by BRAC. The state says the money can be used in addition to other assistance currently available, such as the low interest rate programs announced earlier this year.
When it comes to environmental compliance, GSA's pre-competed on-demand contracts make it easy to access expert environmental and energy management services or buy energy-efficient, earth-friendly products. To learn more, visit gsa.gov/gogreen/options. That's gsa.gov/gogreen/options. GSA, your everything source for energy, environmental, and sustainability management solutions.
Droopy memory, sagging attention span. Sure signs your brain is getting flabby. Time to get it off its medulla oblongata and make it work. Pick up a crossword puzzle. Learn a new song on the piano. Eat your cereal with a spoon in your other hand. Kaiser Permanente reminds you that anything you do out of your routine challenges your lovely lobes. For better memory, clearer thinking, and sharper focus, spend a few minutes a day with some mental gymnastics. Find a new route to work. Recite the alphabet backwards. Grocery shop starting at the other end of the store. Just 10 minutes of these routine breakers can improve your brain's speed, retention, and memory, even help prevent Alzheimer's disease. So do for your brain what you do for your body. Get it up off its behind and build some mind muscle. Check out our brain teaser at kp.org/thrive. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Christopher C. Harmon. He's also the Major General Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University, where he teaches about terrorism and counterterrorism strategies to fellow Marines. Chris, we were talking about, you know, how terrorism begins. I wanted to really touch on this. How old is terrorism? I mean, you know, it's, you know, some people think it's just 9/11. Some people may remember a couple of things before that. But how old and how far does terrorism go back?
One can take it back almost as far as there are good, clear chronicles. So there are periods in Judaic opposition to the Roman occupation, which might or might not be called terrorism, but what usually is, as by the author in our book, Andrew Nick Pratt, sees the kinds of activities of those activists against the Romans as terrorism. Certainly, in more modern times, I like to look at literally the end of the 1700s, because during the French Revolution, a lawyer named Maximilien Robespierre specifically addressed the subject in the Parliament in France. And he basically urged in quite an important speech that in a revolution you need virtue and you need terror. By that he meant you need, you know, clear eyes about your political objectives and the right ideals, and you also need a ferocious kind of force used to compel people to come along with your vision. It's a very disturbing speech, but an important one, because he specifically used the word terror, and he used it in a way that was supposed to be a good thing. It was to ensure the success of the revolution.
And it was basically meant to, anybody who heard this speech should be scared that we will begin to inflict terror upon you if you don't go with our ideas.
That if you don't follow the French revolutionaries, if you're a reluctant Catholic priest, if you're an old-style monarchist, if you're a peasant that is holding hard to the affiliations of your old feudal lords, that you could face the guillotine. And many did. And eventually Robespierre himself faced it as the revolution consumed itself. But, you know, a couple of contemporary scholars have said that, you know, terrorism is so hard to define that you just can't really get a good definition, because it's too much of a political hot potato. It's a value judgment word. But in fact, Robespierre said right then in 1794 that he knew very much what it was, and he knew how it worked. And he intended to use it for what he thought were good purposes. So there was a state actor. Today we face sub-state actors, but they have many of the same ideas about how explicitly to use fear to change political things.
You know, you just made like a real interesting point that these people felt that they were doing things that were good, you know, for a good purpose. So they felt in their mindset that we are the just ones, but we will inflict terror. I mean, it's almost kind of it's a conflict of, you know, inflicting terror for good. But how do people resolve that?
There is a sort of perverse idealism involved in some of these fellows. If we go back to someone like Prabhakaran, he saw that as the British Empire retreated out of Sri Lanka, the position the Tamils had might suffer vis-a-vis those of others on the island, the Sinhalese majority. And so there were people like him, activists, political figures, cultural observers, who feared for the future. And so in a kind of a fit of Tamil nationalism, but also he has a terrible violent streak, or did, he founds the prelude to the Tamil Tigers. That's about 1972, and then more formally about 1974. And that's an example of a guy who I'm sure would have argued that he was an idealist. I'm sure many Tamils thought that it was good to have someone strong standing up for them.
Sure.
But in fact, the kinds of activities he was engaged in were brutal, and it was a good window into terrorism. His earliest victims included many other Tamils. If you were a moderate Tamil politician, he'd try to get you out of the limelight or he might kill you. The same thing was done later by people like Arafat against other Palestinian nationalists. And so these guys have a drive which can be called a kind of perversely idealistic, but they also end up very early on attacking their own people. Killing fellow cohorts in the movement who are not extreme enough, killing others of the same religion or the same nationality that aren't extreme enough.
That creates their power.
It does. It sure does. One of the earliest modern cases of this, which we haven't discussed yet, is the FLN, the National Liberation Front in Algeria.
Okay.
Very famous group, founded in 1954. They saw right away their targets weren't just French police or French army, that they were other Algerians who weren't joining the revolution. And so the collaborators with the French were among those to be targeted.
Wow.
So there's a kind of idealism in some of these guys, but it is very warped.
Let's go into this. You know, you got this chapter kind of going into chapter 1.2 in the book about how terrorist groups end. And you really kind of walk it back and you cover a lot of different areas from, labor militants to, communism to a lot of different areas to racism and nationalism and everything else. When we talk about terrorist groups and those that have ended, what did you find in your research in terms of, okay, now we know that there's a root cause. We know that it'd be political or ideology or whatever the reason they start. But what ends up happening for them to end? Is it a loss of a leader? Is it that they achieved their goals? Is it that they were, everybody was killed and they felt like it was no longer advantageous to do this? What is it that ends these groups?
I found five or six different major categories that I've been working with since I started lecturing in 2004 on this topic of how terrorist groups end. And the examples include a range of these. For example, we've talked about the LTTE Tigers. They perish from force. Sometimes in the social sciences, academics are a little wary about saying that force can end a terror movement, but I recommend we look at Sri Lanka in the spring of 2009, and we're looking at a conventional army and state apparatus which effectively crushed the LTTE Tigers. And I think that even 3-4 years ago, there was almost no one willing to say that was likely to happen. Hmm. So the first category, Derek, that I found was actually force.
And is it a matter of the government of that country saying we are going to dedicate every single resource that to crush these organizations? And also, did you have a group that was acting almost like an army? So they had kind of a, rather than blending into the population and having more sales, they had more of an established front to kind of say, okay, this is where they're at. We're going to go after them. I mean, what's the different dynamic when we talk about, Al-Qaeda or those here? People may be living, among us, but they may be an isolated cell.
That's a good point. The LTTE Tigers were a terror group that grew and grew until they became literally a guerrilla land army. They had a nascent air force at the end. One of my friends got off an airport stop in Sri Lanka once, and there had just been a bombing by a small aircraft by the LTTE Tigers.
That'd be a scary land.
It was unusual. There were, in fact, quite a large number of suicide-type boats and other naval assets. And in this case, then, they were willing to stake out territory and establish a geographic entity which they regarded as a liberated zone. There are a lot of other groups which don't do that. For example, November 17th, a small group in Greece functioned kind of like what you said, as sort of laying here among us, staying quiet, occasionally publishing missives. And they were a Marxist-Leninist group. But after about 2002 or 3, there was an accident in the group, and one of the bombers was hurt. He ended up in the hospital. He talked to police, and then they collapsed due to law enforcement. So they were all arrested. They were all tried, and it snuffed out November 17th. So that's a case in which good intelligence and law enforcement, rather than sort of army operations, ended that particular terror group.
Christopher Harmon, he's a Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University, where he focuses in and teaches Marines about terrorism and counterterrorism. He also was the director of studies for program on terrorism and security studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies. And he's also an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics, where he teaches about terrorism and counterterrorism. He is one of the experts in our country on terrorism. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Ugh, would you look at this bill?
Tired of paying way too much to your alarm company and not getting real security service? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems and pay just $18.95 a month, and there's no cost to switch. Why Ackerman? Ackerman has more than 40 years of industry-leading experience and was recently named Dealer of the Year out of over 30,000 companies. Ackerman has its own UL and CSAA 5 Diamond Certified Monitoring Center. Put simply, with Ackerman Security Systems, you get the most qualified professionals in the industry monitoring your home for just $18.95 a month. Over 180,000 people enjoy peace of mind with Ackerman. So whether you want a new system or want to switch to reliable monitoring for just $18.95 a month, call 888-999-1070, 888-999-1070, or visit AckermanSecurity.com. Federal employees, call today and get 4 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service.
The latest from the Federal Security Spotlight, brought to you by Cisco.
Good cybersecurity is critical for protection of the nation's critical infrastructure, but it's not enough to fully ensure reliable operation of industry. Here's Mark Bregman, the Chief Technology Officer of Symantec.
Security alone is not sufficient. Trying to protect against these threats is not sufficient because security is never perfect. What's necessary is also to ensure resilience, that in the case that an attack is successful, companies can quickly recover.
To hear the entire show, log on to federalnewsradio.com. Will the top-of-mind security issues of today be the issues facing government tomorrow? Get the latest from federal experts on FISMA reform, the cyber initiative, how government is combating botnets, spyware, and other cyber evils, and more. Listen to Federal Security Spotlight, sponsored by Cisco, airing Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. or on demand at federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Security Spotlight is brought to you by Cisco, the leader in federal IT security.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we've been having a very, very interesting and educational conversation on the topic of terrorism. As we all know, terrorism is all around us, and that we're dealing with it on an everyday scenario. It's been in the news recently about current terrorist threats against Europe and the United States. I have with me Christopher C. Harmon. He's the Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University, where he focuses in on teaching about terrorism and counterterrorism to Marines at Quantico. He also was the Director of Studies at the Program for Terrorism and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Europe. Chris, we were just kind of talking over the break, and you mentioned the FLN as kind of a key case.
They're a good case of how terror groups may end, and they're a disturbing reminder to us that sometimes these fellows win. The National Liberation Front in Algeria famously defeated France, and France had as many as 500,000 soldiers in Algeria, apart from various police and other intelligence assets, and yet they still lost. The FLN waged a very successful campaign at the United Nations, in the region, in diplomatic terms, using well their assets in Morocco, Egypt, other places, which give them a kind of basis to operate out of. They were highly, highly successful, and in 1962, they walk into the capital of Algiers. Today, the FLN remains the largest political party in the Congress, and in fact, they ran the country up until very recently. So for decades, they were able to define Algerian affairs in the way they wanted, and they got that success in part with terror, in part with a good, clear political program, in part with good guerrilla warfare against French soldiers. But it was their bombings in places like the capital, where they used plastique in things like dance halls and bars, which really put them on the terrorism map. They're a reminder that sometimes these groups do win.
Wow. You know, I think that's an important point, because we talk about, and as we read through the book, I mean, people who used to be designated as terrorists by State Department and other places, FLN, ANC in South Africa was designated as a terrorist group. And you know, there are some groups that seem to have a political movement who use terror, you know, as part of their process, but also seem to also start using other methods of tradecraft or diplomacy or propaganda and other things like that to begin also trying to influence people in that country. Is that the case?
I think it is. And a good example, ANC is a great example. You mentioned them, of some of an organization that could use terror tactics by a group like the Spear of the Nation during a certain period of the fighting, but also had a very protracted political campaign, which was sophisticated and had a lot of foreign allies, and changed a lot of minds. I mean, I used to work for the House of Representatives, and whether to put sanctions on South Africa at the time was a big question for everyone in Congress, because there was an attempt to improve South Africa, but also to not get too close to terror operations by ANC. Well, today that's a fairly happy story, a fairly happy outcome. A group that followed directly on the Algerian model was the PLO.
Okay.
Just as they declared that they would become the only representatives of the Algerian political soul, the PLO took the same line, and Mr. Arafat was very good at that. He used groups like Black September and his reconnaissance forces for terror operations, but he also had a sophisticated political angle. He built schools. He ran a large economic empire, which employed people in Africa and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. He was a good diplomat. You remember his speech at the United Nations. He kind of followed the FLN model, and he was highly successful. And now, in our time, after years of opposing the PLO, here we are sitting here in this studio. We both pay taxes, and the Palestine Authority gets a little bit of our money every year.
That's right.
We've been aiding since about 1990, and then increasingly later, we've been aiding the Palestine Authority in its attempt to build a secular and reasonable state within the Middle East. So this is a group which has, I would say, is sort of two-thirds successful or half-successful.
Yeah. But they're still around. And in your book, you talk about the long term. There are some groups that end very, very quickly, but then there are some groups that have now been able to withstand, you know, decades. And as you mentioned, they, you know, they're, whether it be the ideology or, I mean, your key area about they win or they get some level of success that either puts them in political power or anything like that. You know, one question I've always had is, and when we think about terrorism, is how are these groups funded? You know, I mean, even as we think about Al-Qaeda, are they funded for a reason that says that somebody is providing them money to say that we believe in what you're doing and we want to see you win this outcome? It takes a lot to do training. It takes a lot to get weapons. It takes a lot. Are there rogue states who are funding these people? Are there other parties? I mean, where does all these resources come for them to, you know, do these terror campaigns?
That's a great question. And Washington has a couple of really first great experts in this field, too, like Matthew Levitt, one of the local think tankers, Selena Rialiu, who contributed a book on finance, a chapter on finance to our book. She's an independent consultant. She used to be at the State Department trying to impound terrorist funding. I've lectured on this as well at the Marshall Center. With this topic, I think you're struck by the diversity of income from terror groups. There are very few that have only one source. So, for example, Hezbollah gets at least $100 million a year from Iran. That is an amazingly important reality. But Hezbollah also has private donors. Hezbollah has been engaged in bizarre things like the smuggling of cigarettes here within the United States in order to use differing tax systems to make money on the sale of smuggled cigarettes. They have dealt in drugs. They have a little business enterprises in several major sectors of Latin America, which are getting increasing attention. So I think they look for a kind of diversity in their portfolio, if you like, even though Iran is overwhelmingly important to them. Other groups have a mix of their own methods. The old traditional IRA provosts, for example, used to run gaming tables. They sold liquor. They did extortion. They did bank theft. They used to knock off post offices. They had a very varied supply.
So almost like organized crime.
Very much they were an organized crime, and then there were a lot of Americans who were happy to send them checks. Mm-hmm. So they had also a very diverse portfolio. Right. In short, each group has its own sources, and they have proven to be rather flexible. It makes it very hard to chase down terrorist financing. I would say if we want to ask about how terror groups end, we can hurt them by getting at their money. We're not likely to make them stop.
With some of the best examples in terms of, and let's maybe talk from this context, the short-term ones that have ended, they were either, you know, rooted out by just overwhelming force or maybe some good intelligence, like you mentioned, November 17 or things like that. What are some of the other ways that they were kind of rooted out besides them winning?
Sometimes they've gone into Pacific politics. So an interesting group from the old Latin days is the Tupamaros in Uruguay. That had been a very stable state, very calm, very wealthy. The Tupamaros basically tore it apart in the early 1970s, even though they were a very small organization. Regrettably, security forces couldn't handle them, and so the army stepped in and with a coup basically crushed that organization. But the point for your question is some of the Tupamaros then moved into Pacific politics. They said, okay, well, I'm a radical, but it doesn't mean I have to be a terrorist. I can put my ideas into play in labor unions, in city politics, in national politics. Today, Uruguay is run by a fellow who used to be a Tupamaro guerrilla. A lot of them were killed in the campaign, but a lot survived, and some moved into Pacific politics. The same thing happened in El Salvador after our intervention ended there. And there are other cases where American individuals, for example, who used to be in terrorism, moved beyond that sphere and kind of went into community activism. That's true, for example, of a number of the people in the Weatherman organization.
Yeah, I remember that. And we talked about a whole dynamic of people who use bombing tactics and everything else. And then they moved into in Chicago and in city politics and everything else.
Billy Ayers, who did a rather cocky book 5 or 6 years ago that I've reviewed, is among those who doesn't really denounce everything the Weatherman used to do. He's clearly rather pleased with himself about some of it, but he's been careful to say that he's on a different path now, and he's in a different sort of activism. His wife was also in the Weatherman. Mark Rudd, who I gather teaches somewhere in the southern United States, is another case of a senior Weatherman leader who eventually, after many years, moved into a more sort of a calm form of life. Well, some political parties do emerge from former terror groups.
Is that one strategy that we need to think about as we look at this kind of grand strategy that, you know, to assimilate people, to kind of say, listen, you've been on this, you know, kind of state where you've been fighting against us, but now why don't you come into the fold and we'll still listen to your ideas, but, you know, we don't want you to continue to start doing things to harm people.
A great example is U.S. policy on Hamas. That's a way to understand policy on Hamas. These are folks who, since about 87, 88, have been using terrorism, everything from the knife to the car bomb. They're also very sophisticated politically. They have a whole network of social help and organizations, schools, hospitals. They're a formidable opponent. Well, we've preferred to back the Palestine Authority folks since they've rejected terrorism and admitted that Israel has a right to exist. Hamas has not done that yet. So their control of Gaza, although supported by balloting in 2006, is still suspect for us in the government. And so the U.S. government's posture, I think quite reasonably, is Hamas, rewrite your charter. You can keep your old allegiance to the Muslim Brotherhood, but you've also got to disavow violence, which the Brotherhood does on occasion. You've got to admit Israel has a right to exist. You've got to look to a future of Palestine which is sane and somewhat more secular than you have in mind. Their charter is disturbing to read. It's opposed to all peace talks. It's opposed to the Jews and the Zionists and the Americans, and it ridicules Arafat. Hamas has a very fighting charter. And until that changes, they won't ever move into pacific politics, even though they may win elections.
Christopher C. Harmon. He's a Major General Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
There's no better way to study the world's best golf swings than to watch them side by side on the range. Move down the line from Arnold Palmer to Fred Couples to Phil Mickelson, and you notice not just the differences, but the similarities, like their wonderful balance, rhythm, and timing. And if you look closely as they leave, you'll notice something else they have in common. The same timepiece, a Rolex Day-Date. Available in 18-karat white or yellow gold or platinum, the Day-Date is put through 15 days and nights of the most grueling testing before it ever leaves Geneva. That ensures that, like these great golfers, it will perform as well in the real world as it does in practice. To see a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
What will the Fed VIPs be talking about at Fed Talks 2010? Go to FedTalks.com to get the scoop. Fed Scoop will be hosting D.C.'s biggest VIP gathering of the year on Tuesday, October 12th. It's a new fiscal year for the Feds, so come hear about key initiatives and priorities from top federal agency CIOs and CTOs, network with your key prospects, clients, and partners, meet Arianna Huffington, rock out with the DJ to the White House, and enjoy performances from the Arlington rap comedian Go Remy. Go to FedTalks.com to save your spot today.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at avuecentral.com. That's avuecentral.com.
You should never be constrained by your network. That's why government agencies turn to Avaya Government Solutions and Ronco. Their data networking portfolio offers reliable, secure, end-to-end solutions needed to fully recognize the power of real-time communications. Solutions from Avaya and Ronco deliver innovative technology, energy-efficient hardware, and improve the effectiveness of business by creating a simpler, more effective network. The future of data networking has arrived. Learn more at avayagov.com/GSA2010.
Have you delayed putting together an estate plan? Your retirement savings, insurance policies, and real estate are all part of your assets. If you or your partner should ever become incapacitated, who will handle the financial or medical decisions? And how do you want those assets distributed? Hi, I'm Wayne Zell of Zell Law and host of Blueprint for Wealth Saturdays at 10 a.m. Find out how you can better secure your future this Saturday or call me at Zell Law at 571-203-9355. Or visit us on the web at zelllaw.com.
What if I said you had the power to speak Chinese or to dream in French? What if you could even read in Italian? You'd be skeptical, right? What if I could prove it to you with a free demo CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone, one that unlocks your ability to learn any language on Earth? Introducing the all-new, more powerful Rosetta Stone, the only language learning program that literally awakens your natural ability. And for the first time ever, they're inviting you to experience their groundbreaking program, absolutely free, with a free demo CD-ROM. Call 1-800-600-6621 and request yours. Developed around the way you naturally think and learn, Rosetta Stone teaches you your new language with the tools you already have. And now you can experience it for free. Awaken your natural language learning ability today with a free demo CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone. Call 1-800-600-6621 and request yours. Rosetta Stone, your natural ability awakened. That's 1-800-600-6621.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, you need to go back and listen to the previous segments because we've had an interesting discussion about terrorism and the grand strategy towards or against terrorism. There's a book out called Towards a Grand Strategy Against Terrorism that's been written by some of the top officials and top terrorism strategies and counterterrorism strategies in our nation and the world. I have one of them in the studio with me right now. He's Dr. Christopher C. Harmon. He's the Major General Matthew C. Horner, Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University, where he teaches about terrorism and counterterrorism. He's also been the former Director of Studies at the Program on Terrorism and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall, a European Center for Security Studies. And he's also an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics, where he teaches about counterterrorism and terrorism issues. Chris, we were talking over the break, and we kind of mentioned this before we were leaving the last segment about Al-Qaeda. And I think everybody has, you know, because we hear it almost every day. If you're following the news at some point in time, if not every day, every week, we hear about Al-Qaeda in some form or fashion. And even we're starting to even hear about the Taliban in terms of their influence in other places. How do we continue to deal with this? You have a piece in the book about this. How do we deal with this? I mean, do we see an end to, you know, dealing with Al-Qaeda?
I think I'd have to admit that if we'd been doing this interview in 2004 or 2003, I would have been surprised that we could come this far and not have behind bars or in a bag Bin Laden or al-Zawahiri. But we have had many successes against Al-Qaeda, but the campaign against the leadership trying to decapitate it is extremely difficult, and it's not gone nearly as well as we'd like. But as I say, they have a dual center of gravity. We'll have to successfully beat the movement that Al-Qaeda leads. Al-Qaeda and its affiliates is the way the Obama administration defines the enemy, and that's an older term from past administrations in some documents, but it's a good one. To beat Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, we'll have to do more to win the war of ideas as well. A grand strategy has to include intelligence, countering their financing, chasing their leaders. We've got to beat their ideas, and thus far we haven't done well. Our efforts in public diplomacy have been very discouraging.
Do you think that these groups are open to hearing our ideas? I mean, as we talk about the war of ideas, and, you know, we used to have the U.S. Information Agency, we used to have a lot of different other tools to really kind of promote our message. I mean, are they open to hearing that?
I don't think that many of the core people are, but the important audience is especially the Muslim, the Arab populations that are not really that are more on the fence or more neutral or more moderate. Mm-hmm. We can reach them. We have to reach them. I mean, our founding documents declare an interest in so-called a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And our public diplomacy has to do better at reaching those kind of sober individuals abroad. I believe we can do far better. I mean, when a really good fatwa is published by a very sober Sunni council somewhere, like in Britain, as happened 5 or 6 years ago, we should do more to publicize that, to suggest to the world that this isn't just Washington's problem. This is a problem for the world. And when reasonable Muslim scholars look at these ideas and these practices of Al-Qaeda, they repudiate them. Bin Laden's own mentor, one of his Egyptian mentors, recently repudiated him in about 2008. When these things happen, I think we should make more of it. I think we can do more to show how many Muslim victims there are of these Islamist terrorists, which is deplorable. I think we can do more to show the way they try to start a fight between Shia and Sunni. I mean, that's a remarkable fact that when you're a Shiite trying to have a procession for religious reasons in Iraq, there's a high chance of you being blown up, not by the coalition, but right. by other Iraqis right. that are of a different faith.
And that's what we see all the time in Iraq right now, is more against these two different parties.
And yet we've done very little to point out to the way in which Shia are always victimized by the Sunni terrorists of Al-Qaeda. I think, therefore, there's a lot that we can do in the world of ideas where we haven't shown much imagination. Frankly, Derek, what I'd like is some of our foreign friends to do much more. You know, maybe it's a think tank in Turkey. Maybe it's a Sunni council in Belgium. Maybe it's a Moroccan politician with a really good ear. But we need to have folks mounting the political offensive that are not speaking from the White House.
Right.
So the White House can do more, and it should.
We need these community leaders. We need the people in the core communities that people who are being influenced to go this way.
That's very true. And some of the there's some exciting people out doing this. There's a man named Noaz, for example, who's with a think tank in Britain. He's a former extremist Sunni Muslim, and now he spends his time giving lectures to kids about the real evils of those kinds of movements and the way they lead into terrorism. That's a kind of spokesman who can do an immense amount of good. And we, as a U.S. government, with radio stations, with the White House pulpit and everything else, we need to amplify that kind of voice, the defector, the legitimate Muslim scholar.
Al-Zawahiri see them as puppets. I mean, well, you know, some people will look at them and say, you know what, these people are puppets. I mean, of a U.S. administration. I mean, how do you counter that?
That's a great question. And in fact, Mr. Noaz, who's with the Quilliam Foundation in London, gets that kind of critique. You know, he just lives with it. He's a charismatic, brilliant guy. I've seen him lecture several times in Rome and in Garmisch. And he just lives with it. He knows that he was there. He knows that he's repudiated violence. And he trusts himself enough to say, we get money from a lot of places, including the British government, for doing the kind of community outreach we do. It's good work, and I'm here to do it. And that's the kind of confidence and smarts that this takes.
Christopher C. Harmon. He's a Major General Matthew C. Horner Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University. Thank you, Chris, for coming out.
Thanks, Derek.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED. Your source for federal news now.
Mortgages should be illegal because you're getting robbed every month. For example, if you have a typical $200,000 30-year mortgage, you're going to end up paying over $400,000 after interest. That's almost a quarter of $1 million that you could be putting into your pocket instead of the bank's. I want to send you a powerful free CD to show you how. Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My proven system can eliminate your mortgage and all your other debts using just the money you already make. That's right, no credit card debt, no car payment, no mortgage. It's easy, it works.
I will be able to pay off my house in approximately 2.5 years on a 30-year mortgage.
Stop getting robbed of your money and your future. Call now and I'll rush you a free CD today. Call 1-800-500-2884. For your free CD, call 1-800-500-2884. 1-800-500-2884.
HalfPriceDC.com, half-price gift certificates to the area's best restaurants, spas, and more.
This week, buy half-price gift certificates to Bale Vietnamese Food and Deli in Rockville. Delicious food and great customer service at affordable prices.
Sur La Place in the Palisades area of D.C. This Belgian fine dining gem boasts over 20 types of mussels and a unique beverage list. And McLoone's Pier House, National Harbor's newest waterfront dining destination.
See all the offers at halfpricedc.com.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Diaper bag, check. Bouncy seat, check. Stroller, car seat, bottles, butt wipes, and binky, check, check, and double check. Why it takes 30 pounds of equipment to transport one 12-pound baby, we'll never know. So at Kaiser Permanente, we put everything for baby and you in one place. Everything you need, from obstetricians and nurses to nutritionists and pediatricians. A whole care team of specialists assembled to keep your baby and you in top running order, not running around. And you can even go online with My Health Manager to schedule routine appointments, check most lab results, and exchange emails with your Kaiser Permanente doctor's office. Imagine having a conversation with your pediatrician without having to fold or unfold that stroller. Convenient? Check. Efficient? Check. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive. Learn more at kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWW.